where I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. This is Shane R. Monroe, and you are listening to the May 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Welcome to the program. Well, as you may have figured out, the show is a little late this month, and it's going to be a slightly shorter show. May was a very, shall we say, complicated month. If you're interested in knowing more, then check out my sister show, Passenger Seat Radio, where I'll give you all the dirt as to why this month has been a little on the busy side. Another warning with regards to Passenger Seat Radio, those of you who do listen to the other show probably realize that for a short period of time, Passenger Seat Radio was dropped from iTunes. Now, this could easily happen with Retro Gaming Radio as well. I'll just give you a quick story about that, although this will be appearing on Passenger Seat Radio as well. Essentially, something that they were fine with for 3 years of running Passenger Seat Radio, Apple suddenly decided they didn't like on my program, and they unceremoniously dumped Passenger Seat Radio from iTunes. They didn't say why, they gave me no warning, and in fact, they were hesitant to even tell my syndication company, who actually called them in my behalf, and said, what the hell is wrong, why did you disconnect my client's affiliation with iTunes, blah, blah, blah. It turned out that in the show's description, I mention that I'm trying to raise two daughters in a world that expects them to act like whores and sluts. They did not like the term whores and sluts, so they dropped my show off of iTunes, and I lost a bunch of listeners, I lost a bunch of ratings and votes and comments, because they didn't like whores and sluts after 3 years. Yeah. So anyway, so should iTunes and Apple get unceremoniously pissy about this show for some reason, you could expect to see the same thing happen. So, not that I think it'll happen, but fair warning, if I suddenly vanish off of iTunes, either show, obviously check my website, Twitter, Google Plus, and other social networking mediums to figure out why. Let's move on to reader mail. We didn't have any reader mail this month, and it's funny because I know a lot of you are listening to the show. A lot of people are sending in bits and bytes, comments, that sort of thing, but I'm not getting any response much from folks about how they like the show, how they like the format, do they like the topics. It's unusual, and I think people are just so used to having a one-way communication with their information these days through podcasts and whatnot that community building is a little out the door these days, right? You get the show delivered to your phone or your iPad or your iPhone or your Android tablet, and you just listen and you consume it, and you forget that there's actually other people that you might be able to connect with in that community. So I urge you to get involved. Join the Monroe World forums. Join us on Google Plus. Join us on Twitter. Get involved with the show. I think you'll find a lot of like-minded people who are also listening to the show. Well, the editorial commentary this month is called The Chase, The Importance of Pac-Man. And it occurred to me that The Chase is actually a very, very important evolution in video gaming, and yet it's not even something we think about anymore. The Chase is simply assumed. Think about that. Look at all of our modern games, from Call of Duty to just about any game. There's a chase element. There's something stalking you. There's something coming after you. There's AI. Right? And AI may not be a direct chase like in Pac-Man where the ghosts are following you, but there are artificial intelligent routines out there that are giving your enemy the value of the chase. And it's hard to even imagine a video game where we're not inspired by the chase, and yet for so many years we did have it, we did play it. Pac-Man came out in 1980. But there were video games out before then, and there were many video games after that. Let's look at one of the big ones that was out before Pac-Man, Space Invaders, right? Space Invaders had no chase. It had no artificial intelligence. And it was really just an electronic shooting gallery, which I find interesting because one of the forms of interactive entertainment prior to video games, pinball, right? And pinball, if you break it right down to the brass tacks, if you will, it's a shooting gallery. You're using the flipper to shoot a ball at targets. Before then, you actually had actual shooting galleries where you had a BB gun and a bunch of targets set up and you scored points. You shot mechanical ducks down, that sort of thing. Video games simply emulated what was going on before. Look at the video game Carnival. The old video game Carnival. That literally was an electronic shooting gallery. But if you look at it and you think, wow, was Pac-Man really the first? There were many maze games that appeared before Pac-Man. In other words, there were games where you traveled around a maze, maybe you gathered something, and there were enemies in the maze. But if you go back and you look at some of these other items, these other games, there wasn't that chase aspect. It was simply a random guy running around the maze, and you hoped that eventually the bad guy would kill you, or you would run out of time, or you would fail in whatever game objective was in there. And a lot of times it just happened to be chance that the bad guy would get you. Pac-Man came along, and I understand and I realize fully that Pac-Man is pattern-based. If you know the patterns, you can play Pac-Man until it clocks out at 256 screens. And so the game, is it really a chase? Well, sure. Sure it is. There's artificial intelligence attached to them, and if you don't follow a specific pattern that exploits holes in the AI script, and those things exist today in video games. How many times have you played a 3D game, a 3D adventure game, where you can't beat the bad guy until you get him stuck on a rock and you can wail on him? That's exploiting the AI just as much as a pattern inside of Pac-Man. So to say that Pac-Man is not a chase game or artificial intelligence game, no, same idea, right? So we owe a lot to Pac-Man. I mean, Pac-Man really was the first legitimate chase game. And there's a reason why so many games copied it, outright stole it, were inspired by it. And from that point on, we all looked at the ghosts as a physical enemy coming after you. We didn't really have that before. We had space invaders that were descending on top of you. But they were going to come down unless you nuked them all. There was a pattern, and it was a repetitive pattern, and you always knew. So Pac-Man really should be one of the games in the Smithsonian Institute, and it is, next to Dragon's Lair. We owe a lot to that little yellow pizza slice removed from his mouth. We owe a lot to Pac-Man. So give it some thought. You know, it's funny because you can look at a lot of games, and there are many games that don't have a chase factor, right? A lot of casual games. Look at games like, dancing games, right? Rhythm games. None of those really have a chase element. But if you look at the big franchises, I mean, think about it. Think about modern racing games. Even modern racing games have a chase element. Need for Speed. Cops coming after you, right? Same idea. Grand Theft Auto. Even mission-based games have elements of chase. Without Pac-Man, we would not have that direction to go with video gaming. So I challenge you, think about it. Next time you're playing your favorite game, say thank you to Pac-Man, because it was probably the game that somehow, even if it is a totally off-the-mark sort of thing, it's still the game that probably inspired the artificial intelligence, the chase factor of the games you're playing today. This month we continue our anniversaries series, marking the 30th anniversary of the Commodore VIC-20. Now, most of you who've listened to the show, you know my history with the VIC-20, but since we're looking at a retrospective, I'll give you some other information about the VIC-20 and my experience with it. The VIC-20 was the first computer that I ever owned, and I'm almost afraid to ask my mother what she had to sacrifice to put it in the house. This was back when my mom was a single mom. We lived in the slums of Wenatchee, Washington, south side of Wenatchee. There was not a lot of money. My mom worked her ass off night and day just to make ends meet, and somehow, out of the blue, when I must have been, 12, 13, somewhere in there, I'd have to do the math, but she produced a Commodore VIC-20. Now, this was a Commodore VIC-20 with no tape drive, no disk drive, no means of storage. I believe the unit came with three cartridges that I remember. The Count, which was a Scott Adams adventure, Gorf, the popular arcade game, and Omega Race, the not-so-popular but still very cool vector arcade game. Gorf was the bomb. I mean, anybody will tell you who owned the VIC-20. It did not have the warp sequence, but otherwise it was the definitive version of Gorf. In fact, I liked it better on the VIC-20 than I did on the Commodore 64. It came with a spiral-bound book, and in the back of the book were type-in programs, one of them being the infamous Tank versus UFO, which anybody who's owned a VIC-20 or a Commodore 64, especially if you didn't have a tape drive or a disk drive, you probably typed this program in at least once, maybe two or three times like I did. The very first program I tried to write, I wanted to do an adventure game where you were inside of a dungeon, and it was 100 rooms by 100 rooms. So my first line of code was 10 dim rooms, 100, 100. And I ran it, and I was out of memory with one line of code. Obviously, there were better ways to do that. But hey, I was like 12, okay. Anyway, so the VIC-20 was my very first computer I owned. The first one that I used was the TRS-80 Model 3 with 16K of memory. But let's take a look at the specs of the VIC-20. It was a 6502 processor using a very primitive version of the VIC chip. It was 176 by 183 graphics, three voice, one noise channel, mono, and roughly had 5 kilobytes of RAM that you could use. 5 KB, not MB, not GB, KB. The 6502 was already around with the PET computers, but the PET computers were very pricey. The VIC Color video chip was designed by MOS Technology, who Commodore, if you remember from last show, Commodore bought MOS Technology after Texas Instruments screwed them out of the processing chip that they were building for them, and they decided to market it themselves in 1977. But there were no buyers for the VIC chip, so they kind of stagnated. The Apple II got some traction in 1979 with a program called VisiCalc, a spreadsheet package, and Jack Tramiel wanted to play in that same space with the Apple II, and he wanted this to be announceable at 1980's Consumer Electronics Show. So they prototyped a whole bunch of computers. A couple of them, one was called the Other Intellect, which I believe was made by MOS Tech, and the other one was another piece of work called the Micro PET by Robert Jans, I'm assuming. I'm horrible with last names. And he built this in his house, right? Well, Tramiel liked that. I mean, he liked the Micro PET as it was, but it needed more computer stuff in it, something that was a little more home-friendly, if you will. So they got a port of the Commodore BASIC. They used the PETSCII character set, the one that the Commodore 64 and the VIC-20 inevitably used, with the alternate characters, the graphical character sets. You know, if it held down the Commodore key or the control or shift or control key, it would give you alternate characters other than the text. Threw in a 2600 compatible joystick interface, a cartridge port, and an IEEE port. They had tons of 4 kilobyte SRAM chips laying around, so that's what they shoved into the unit. In the end, it was really just a color PET with a 22-column color display. Now, the general managers of Commodore did not want a low-cost color computer. Tramiel followed the computers for the masses, not for the classes philosophy, and said that the Japanese were coming with these types of computers, so we will become the Japanese. And oddly enough, Commodore Japan got the job of making the VIC-20 happen. They created the VIC-1001, which would end up being the VIC-20 in the United States. Commodore had a hot new marketer named Michael Tomczyk. This is a weird name, T-O-M-C-Z-Y-K. He wrote up a memo recommending programmable function keys, a full-size keyboard, and an RS-232 port. And user-friendliness was the prime directive of the VIC-20, and they wanted to send it out to the masses at $299. So they put together a special team to do colorful packaging and manuals and get software ready for launch. Now, here's an interesting little factoid here. The text adventure guy, Scott Adams, was contracted to make games for the VIC. Now, to get around the limitations of the small amount of memory, they used cartridges, 16 kilobyte cartridges, and they created 5 cards for the VIC, generating $1.5 million in sales just on those 5 cartridges, thanks to Scott Adams. Instead of authorized dealers like the PET was sold, the VIC was sold in retail store, and in fact it was Kmart's very first computer. Interestingly enough, frontman William Shatner, Captain Kirk himself, became the advertising spokesperson, pushing it as more than just a video game. Henry Morgan became the voice of Commodore in all their product ads. One of the main goals with VIC's memory is that it would hold approximately 1 page of text, and that did that, but just barely. VIC was criticized for being underpowered, but believe me, it didn't matter. The VIC sold a ton. Tomczyk contracted an outside firm to deliver what was probably the most brilliant step ever done by any computer company, created the VIC modem. This was a modem on a cartridge. This would be the first sub-$100 computer modem, and it was the very first modem to sell over 1 million units. Tomczyk went on to be even more brilliant and created something called the Commodore Information Network, which was part of the CompuServe system. They gave away $200 worth of time with the VIC modem for you to get on CompuServe and be inside the Commodore Information Network. This was for users to exchange information, and it gave the users a self-help method, as Commodore's customer support centers were very strained because of the popularity of the VIC. So Tomczyk was brilliant. He gave away all this time with the VIC modem. He created something that brought, I would dare say, brought telecommunications to the masses. It was brilliant. 1982 was the heyday year of the VIC, selling 800,000 units that year alone, topping 1 million total by the end of the year. And at one point, 9,000 units a day were being produced. That year, the Commodore 64 was brought out, and while it had slow sales, by 1983, it effectively buried VIC-20 into a nice PVC coffin, if you will. In January 1985, the VIC-20 was officially discontinued. Here's some interesting facts that I put together about the VIC-20 for you. Linux's founder, Linus Torvalds, Is that how you say that? I've really got to get like a translator for last names. His first computer was a VIC-20. The VIC-20 led the way in magazines. In fact, the very first type-in programs were made popular by the VIC-20. By 1985, there were 300 titles on cartridge and over 500 on tape for the VIC-20. That's an amazing number when you consider, I think there were less than 500 total Atari 2600 games. There was over 800 titles available for the VIC-20. The VIC-20 was one of the few computers at the time that supported customized character sets. That was the ability to go in and overwrite the actual keyboard graphics with your own customized characters. Despite the popular belief, there were no hardware sprites on the VIC-20. The VIC-20 did have a floppy drive, the 1540, which was released in 1981, but it was very expensive. Most people stuck with tape and cartridges. However, there were, oddly enough, many third-party tape adapters available for the VIC-20, meaning you did not have to buy the $60 or $70 Commodore data set. You could, in fact, use one of your own tape players or tape recorders to actually interface with your VIC. Of course, they weren't quite as reliable as the data set was. The VIC-20 still has a very devoted following. In fact, there are many, quote, mega cartridges available. In fact, one of the games that's included on some of these mega cartridges is an amazing version of Berserk. And we're going to have a video there. Alex is going to throw a video up for you on YouTube showing just how great this Berserk port is for the VIC-20. Well, there you have it, folks, our anniversary look at the Commodore VIC-20, my first computer I ever owned. And oddly enough, my parents still have that computer up in their attic somewhere. Someday I'm going to have to pick it up and throw down a little gorf because I do miss that quirky little VIC-20. We have some great treats for you in this month's Bits and Bytes. Let's get started. First off, this was plucked from Google Plus, and I don't remember who actually gets credit for this one. I'm sorry. I'll make amends on another show. Mind Candy is a series of video DVDs that actually contain famous demos from the PC and the Amiga. Mind Candy Volume 2 is the Amiga volume. Now, here's the best part. They had a goal to sell a certain number of these, and once they reached that goal, they released it for free. So now you can actually get the Mind Candy Volume 2 Amiga demos for free using torrents or FTP, whatever you'd like to get. And you can get a PAL or NTSC version. And it's absolutely fantastic. This has got the stuff that you want to see. Nine Fingers, State of the Art, Kefren's Desert Dream. All of the great Amiga demos are on one disc. And here's the best part. Audio commentary. Right? Sometimes the actual scene members themselves are giving you the backgrounds of the demos. It's amazing. Kefren's Desert Dream was actually a retaliatory strike against the group Melon. It's amazing the sort of things you can find out about on this disc. And there's a ton of them. They've got beautiful menus. It's top-notch production. You actually get to see the demos as close as possible without having to come up with an emulator and configure it and all that stuff. You can just throw the disc in and sit back and enjoy. So that's Mind Candy Volume 2 for free. Download the ISO in either PAL or NTSC. Great stuff. Fantastic. I got a chance to look at a bunch of them and listen to some of the commentaries. Absolutely fantastic. All right, what's up next? Wolfenstein 3D. One of the very first first-person shooters out there, predating Quake and Doom. They turned 20 years old this last month in May. And there's a browser version that you can play right off of The Verge's website. We're going to give you a link to that article. And you can play it right there in your browser and remember just how fun that was. And I got to admit, I played a lot of this. I didn't have a PC at the time, but we did have them at work when I was on the submarine. And I will admit that I probably played a little too much of it on government time, but it was an excellent game for the time, and it was really sort of the precursor to all the games that we're playing now. So give a little props, give a little respect, and go try out Wolfenstein 3D in your browser. All of the episodes are included in there, and it looks like a pretty faithful reproduction. Again, all playable in your browser. That's good stuff. Let's see, who submitted that one? I thought I got... that was from me. A couple other people, I think, submitted it later, but I was the one that put it in the list. Okay, here we go. Space Invaders Chairs. This is from Ronald Smith, a regular contributor. These chairs look like actual Space Invaders. Let's see. Space Invaders chair doesn't look like it'd be comfortable. My arms definitely wouldn't sit right on this armrest, but it sure looks awesome. At least you have a place to sit while fending off alien invaders. Becomes less important than actually doing nothing because you'll look cool doing it. And they've got these in red, green, purple. I'm not sure what these things run. Let's see. But we'll give you a link there to pick them up. But still, I mean, these are way cool. I don't know exactly how big these things are, but I'd love to have one of those blue ones. That looks awesome. So remember the Vectrex? 30-year-old guy, another one of those systems that we need to do a little anniversary tribute to. The Vectrex is the, for those of you who are unaware, the Vectrex is a vector-based home portable console. It included its own vector screen, its own controller, and its own little TV, if you will, and it sat on your desktop. And it's actually one of the cooler-looking ones. I'd actually like to own one at some point. But they do tend to go bad a lot, and they do require some maintenance, which probably isn't the best for me. But they are working, they have created a 64K audio-visual demo to be done right here on the Vectrex. And when I say demo, I'm talking about like a mega demo, where they show off, you know, raster bars and all that sort of thing. But in this case, of course, it's done with Vector graphics. So it's actually pretty cool. And they have a video that you can watch it, so you don't actually have to have a Vectrex to use it. And it's really pretty neat to see what these guys have managed to put together in 64K of memory on this crazy 30-year-old video game system. So it's definitely worth checking it out. And if you actually have a Vectrex, I do believe you can get this thing to actually run on your Vectrex. And of course, as you know, with vector graphics, it's fun to see it on a screen videotaped, but it's more fun to actually see it live. So if you've actually got a Vectrex, you might want to check this one out. Okay, what's next on the list here? Oh, this is cool. Somebody created, let's see, let me give some credit here. Oh, this is Alex J. Lopez, although a bunch of other people sent it in later. This is a replica of the Star Wars arcade machine that's about the size of a bottle of wine. It's a 1-6 scale, 12-inch replica. It's powered by a cannibalized Kainu handheld gaming system. And of course, that little guy can run MAME for All. And it's pretty cheap. It's about $120. You can get one from, this is from Game Park Holdings, by the way, the people who made the GP2X. He actually made it out of a torn apart Game Park Holdings handheld game system. And he put together little controls. And you can actually play with this little miniature yoke control, working yoke control, right there on the machine. It's totally cool. There's a video here you can see. I'm not sure what Alex is going to put up, if it's just the link or the video. But, wow, how cool is that? It looks like a little Star Wars game. It's got a little speaker, the whole bit. Sometimes people that have too much time on their hands actually do produce something very cool. I'd love to have one of those. But it costs like $200 to make that thing. Let's see. Next up, Super Mario Reimagined in one-screen levels. This I ran across, and I just thought it was bizarre. So, as part of a 48-hour game development challenge known as Ludum Dare, Super Mario Summary condenses all 32 levels from the original Super Mario Brothers into a single frame for each screen. The game was created by Johan Petitz, creative director for Swedish developer Free Lunch Design, and relies on the same basic mechanics of the original: collect coins, smash Goombas, and reach the flagpole. The result is a surprisingly challenging and entertaining Flash-based browser game, perfect for lunch hour entertainment at the office. So as I said before, they take each level and they've condensed it. They get most of the elements, the Goombas, the warp pipes, the coins, everything kind of condensed down into a single screen, and you have to get to the flag. Very cool. I got a chance to play just a little bit of it. You know, I didn't have a lot of time, but it plays like Mario Brothers. You know, you jump and hit the Goombas and get the flagpole. It's pretty cool. Here's that Vectrex demo, by the way. That was Martin Parrott hooked us up with that, one of our good Google Plus buddies. Oh, here we go. I like this one. Let's see, who submitted this? Oh, this was another one that I dug up. Time Traveler was Sega's answer to a holographic Dragon's Lair. For those of you who've never seen it, it looked like a big white I don't even know what you'd call it. Maybe an igloo. It looked like an igloo with a face cut out of it. And you would go over there, and inside this face that was cut out of the igloo, you would actually see realistic looking, they weren't real holograms, of course, but they were fake, realistic looking, three-dimensional graphics. And it wasn't like computer graphics, it was real video. Just like you'd see out of Star Wars or something, it was like the coolest thing I'd ever seen. But essentially it was a quick time event game like Dragon's Lair. Move here, move there, push the button to shoot the gun. But they did have some cool things like time reversal cubes that you could actually rewind time if you messed up. It's the first time I think I've ever seen that. I'm not sure if, because that's been done quite a few times, right? The Sands of Time, and they did the rewinding of the time when you pour the sand out. This might be the first time I've ever seen that. Anyway, it was a brief success. Unfortunately, what buried poor Time Traveler into the ground was something, a little something called Street Fighter II, which is arguably one of the most, if not the most, popular fighter games of all time. Which is really funny because, you know, Dragon's Lair managed to kick the pants off of a lot of other games simply because it looked incredible. This took that Dragon's Lair philosophy and turned it into a frickin' hologram. It was incredible. Unfortunately, or fortunately if you were Capcom, Street Fighter II took all the thunder away from Time Traveler. And unfortunately, Time Traveler didn't do as good as it could have. However, as a follow-up to Time Traveler, Sega realized that fighting games must have some bucks behind it. So they created something called Holosseum, which was a fighting game sort of like Street Fighter, but used the holographic Time Traveler cabinet. As you may or may not have guessed, because you probably have never heard of it, it obviously did not have the same impact as Street Fighter II did. My guess is they probably should have figured out how to take Street Fighter II, license it from Capcom, or work with Capcom, and put it into their Time Traveler cabinet into some sort of a 3D fighting game. But they didn't do that. But it's interesting, right? I never really put the pieces together as to why Time Traveler kind of came and went. And this was in 1991, for those of you who are wondering roughly about the time frame. So I thought that was a really neat story. Our buddies over at Cloanto sent me over Amiga Forever 2012 R2. And this is yet another update to the Amiga Forever 2012 package. If you already own Amiga Forever 2012, you will get this as a free update. So what is new with R2? Well, first of all, for those of you who are really interested in the RP9 package, that's the container files that you can build on your own that contain game ROMs, screens, what other kind of stuff's in there, documentation. They created this RP9 format as a retro gaming platform container. Anyway, so they have an improved interface that you can access the RP9 stuff and build your own RP9 files, which is great. There's some support for some new systems, including AROS and Walker, some new MIDI stuff. It's a faster code base for the player, which has always been fairly fast. They moved the Plus Edition to DVD, so they can actually give you more videos and good stuff. And there's actually a social network integration that'll let you post what you're currently playing to your favorite social networks. Not my favorite thing in the world, but I know some people like that. So, if you are interested and you are holding out on buying Amiga Forever and the Commodore 64 Forever packages for 2012, now you get extra features for the same price. And if you're already a 2012 user, then your software Explorer package should have already updated your software for you. What's next here? Let's see. Starting to run a little tight here. Oh, speaking of video gaming furniture, Vince Dickinson sent in the Master System couch. Do you remember the Sega Master System? The black and orange. Had a lot of arcade ports. Not all of them were all that good, though. Phantasy Star, good stuff. Anyway, well, somebody made a couch out of it with controller pillows. Absolutely totally cool, and there's a picture here for you to see. I'm assuming by now Alex has already put that over for you. I love stuff like that. I really do. I love people taking and making furniture and wall stuff out of that. I love it. I love when people make murals out of friggin' Legos for Mario. It's just too cool. Well, gang, that's going to wrap it up for Bits and Bytes. Now, remember, Bits and Bytes is indeed funded by you, if you will, by sending in your articles to bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com or shooting them over to us on Google+, or, of course, on Twitter. We'll see them as well. So be sure, send them in. Maybe we'll read your story on the air and comment and give you a little plug at the same time. So please do support Bits and Bytes and send us your stuff. It's important. This month we have two reviews for you, one a PC title and one for the Android, and I believe it is also available for iOS. Up for the PC is Legend of Grimrock, which is a fantastic dungeon crawler in the vein of Eye of the Beholder, Dungeon Master 2, Bard's Tale, and many others. You're going to love that. And Gianna Sisters for Android is, of course, a port of the 8-bit slant 16-bit classic, very blatantly stolen Mario Brothers in the way of a girl running through a fanciful land in Gianna Sisters, or Gianna Sisters, however you would like to pronounce it, the great Gianna Sisters, if you will. Let's start with Legend of Grimrock. Now, roll the time machine back and think of some of the great dungeon crawlers that you've played. Most of us remember Dungeon Master 2. Started off as an Atari ST title, almost immediately ported over to the Amiga. Full stereo sound. You could actually hear monsters walking behind you. And these were what I would call near real-time games. They weren't real-time 3D adventure games like you might play now from a first-person perspective. And they usually fixed the camera in a particular view so you could look straight or turn a full 90 degrees one way or the other, possibly back up and walk forward. But you were always kind of limited in a focal point. And that gave the developers sort of a fixed environment to work with. As you would walk around these, quote, dungeons, right? Sometimes they would take you outside, but most of the time it was dungeon-oriented. You would walk around and you would combat monsters. Now, the monster fighting, again, was in something I would call real-time. When your characters would make a move, cast a spell, swing the sword, their movements would time out until the kind of the turn was over. But there was nothing that said, you know, round one, round two. It's not like the button masher, kind of the Final Fantasy fights where you take turns round after round. Okay, so I set this guy up to attack, this guy's going to cast a spell, this guy's going to defend, and you hit go, and then the monsters do their attack, then you do your attack, wash, rinse, and repeat. These actually have to be done in pseudo real time. So if you just stand there with a monster in front of you, they will hack at you until you're dead. You can dodge and evade by moving out of the way or what you might call strafing right and left, moving right and left without actually turning first, or backing up. These were all options that you could do, and if you did the timing right, the monster would make his attack and miss, and then you could get a moment to recoup and send your guys after the monsters. Well, in these games, there were all sorts of things. You had projectile weapons like rocks. You had swords that would reach very, very close. You had pole arms that could reach two or three squares away. You had spells. You had all sorts of different means of attacking. If that wasn't enough, you also had to deal with the perils of the dungeon. There may be traps. There may be hidden areas that you have to go and find a little niche in a rock somewhere, push the button, and that would activate a series of doors that would open. There were teleporters. There were all sorts of things to make the dungeon interesting. And in some cases, there were hidden areas inside the dungeon where you could find bonus stuff, as well as navigating through the dungeon. Now, in the old days, you had to do your own cartography. In other words, you had graph paper in stacks, and as you navigated through the dungeon, you would draw a cell on one of the boxes, and the cell would represent what you were just on. There's a wall to my right, there's a wall to my left, and I can go forward and backward, and there's nothing else here. I move forward, I put a wall on the left, a wall on the right, and in front of me there's a T, so I block the T off with the graph paper, and now I'm going to go right, but I'm going to leave the left open so I know that I've got to come back to that at some point. Now, a lot of people argue that auto mappers were the greatest thing since sliced bread. For those of you who are old school, sometimes auto mapping takes away from the game. Part of the fun is the journey, keeping very detailed maps. I know with Legacy of the Ancients, one of my favorite adventure games of all time, I had extremely detailed maps of the Galactic Museum, of every dungeon, of every town. I had it all sketched out. And these maps were actually somewhat valuable because we didn't have the internet back then. And if your friends were playing the game and they ended up at, Pirate Island or whatever, then your map would help them avoid traps, know where the major monsters were, and know exactly where they were going, sometimes 10 levels down into these big dungeons where they had to retrieve a key or whatever it was that they needed. There were also puzzles to be solved in some cases. Pressure plates might exist in one area of the dungeon, and you have to find a rock or something else to put on the pressure plate, which would open a door somewhere else in the dungeon. And then once you went through that door, it would probably close. Sometimes there would be writings on the walls, and the walls would say, you know, light to all ye who pass here, right? And so you can't pass through until you put a torch in the sconce next to this sign. And all of a sudden you'd be, quote, lighting the way, and you would then be ready to move forward. So there were a bunch of different elements. Well, of these elements, almost all of them are favored, right? Doing your own maps. These pseudo real-time fights are really interesting. For anybody who was turn-based fighting games like Final Fantasy or some of the newer Japanese RPGs where you're taking turns, this is a very different it's a very different methodology of fighting. It's not turn-based, but it's not arcade action real time. It's really its own genre of gaming, and it's one that a lot of people love. Well, part of the problem with some of these old games are, well, there's tons of them around, the Eye of the Beholders, the Gold Box games, all of these things. The problem is they don't run on modern hardware, and if they do, they're a little bit dated. Well, let's enter Legend of Grimrock. Legend of Grimrock's goal was to bring this exact genre of game up to 2012 standards. And believe me, they were successful. Super high resolution graphics, animated enemies, all of the stuff that you love about those games is here. Beautiful lighting effects. You can actually free look with the mouse. So far, and I played the game, I think, 5 or 6 hours now, I haven't actually needed the free look, but it's available. And it's exactly the game you remember, right? You can walk through the dungeon, you turn right, you turn left, strafe right. You gotta find the niches in the walls to unlock stuff. You pull the chains to open the doors. You gotta solve minor puzzles. You walk into a room and you get ambushed by billions of guys and you die like 17 times trying to figure out exactly how you can get them off your back, you know, by backing yourself into a corner and taking them on one at a time. All of this stuff is there. And it is absolutely gorgeous. It's beautiful. You can play it in just about as high a resolution as you want. You can play it windowed. You can play it full screen. And it is, here's the best part. $15, right? $15 for this outstanding game. And let me tell you something. I mean, I'm 6 hours in, and I don't think I'm anywhere close to being done with this thing. And there's a little bit of story, but you know what? These games aren't about stories. They're about adventuring. They're about finding every little nook and cranny. They're about digging up the extras, solving the puzzles, killing the bad guys, leveling up, grinding. That's what these games are about. Unlocking new spells, getting better equipment, shifting your armor around, right? The hand-me-down process. You get a new sword, it goes on the fighter gives it to the bard gives his sword to the thief, right? So you know, it's the standard deal. It's like hand-me-downs. It's player maintenance. It's all the sort of things that either you love it or you hate it. I happen to love it. I know a lot of people out there do, because these games were incredibly popular for an incredibly long period of time. So what about the auto mapper? Here's the brilliant part. You can have the game map for you, or you can do it yourself for pleasure. Now, here's the cool part about that, though. Even if you auto map, it still won't let you view it while you're moving around. So, and just like in the really old days, if you wanted to look at your map, you had to stop playing and bring a map up and put it in front of you. So even if it's an auto mapper, that's still done on a screen that you can't see. At first that bothered me, and then I realized that kind of makes it part of the experience. You know, that's what you did in the old days. You weren't looking like a Diablo-style heads-up display map. You had to look down at your graph paper, look back up at the screen, move a few times, look back at your graph paper, move a little bit. For the most part, though, the mapping won't get in the way, and here's why. The levels are laid out incredibly well. So you're not constantly backtracking. What did I miss? What did I miss? What did I... here's a turn I missed. I need to go back here. It's one of those games where you can kind of walk in a path and get from A to B, but if you want to see C and D along the way, you can. And eventually you're going to want to, because C and D sometimes contain better weapons or better armor or things that you might find useful. There are hidden areas that kind of keep you guessing and looking around the dungeons. And of course, you'll use your map to help you find those hidden areas, because obviously until you find them, they're not on the map. So you have to say, well, why is there a big space in here? Wouldn't that make sense if there was something hidden in here? So, as I said, this is the sort of game that you know the genre, you've played the genre to death, you love it, you're ready for something new on modern hardware. Legend of Grimrock is it. And I believe that anybody who loves the genre will find this to be one of the greatest games. $15, it's available at greatoldgames.com, GOG.com. $15, no DRM, no phoning home, no being connected to the internet 24/7 to play a single player game. It installs, it's a 477 megabyte download, so you know the graphics are pretty decent for that kind of size, right? And again, it's got autosave, it's got, you know, you can save yourself, multiple slots, blah, blah, blah. It's all the same stuff that you would expect and you would love. So I highly recommend Legend of Grimrock. It's again $15. Absolutely fantastic. Worth your time, worth your energy, and believe me, you'll know within 10 or 15 minutes if this sort of genre is for you. Most people who are going to be playing this game, you already know that this game is for you. Spend the $15, throw down, you're going to love it. All right, so there you have it, Legend of Grimrock. Next up, Gianna Sisters, the great Gianna Sisters. This is, of course, a straight port, 20-year-old port of the great Gianna Sisters, which was for the Commodore 64. And let's be honest, this is Super Mario Brothers. It's shameless, and when you see it, you're going to go, holy hell, it's completely stolen from Mario Brothers. Now, how exactly did they get away with that? Now, here's the cool part. Now, what is, for those of you who, you guys know what Super Mario Brothers is, right? Do I need to go over this? Essentially, this is a run-and-jump platformer-style game, side-scrolling. There's 80 levels total in this game, so it's going to keep you busy. 32 retro levels with old graphic design going back to the old Gianna Sisters. Let's see. So it does have some on-screen controls, as well as being able to use Xperia Play Optimized, which is great if you have an Xperia phone, or you're willing to sync up your Wii Remote control to your device, your Android device, to play it with that. Nicely enough, the game auto-detects whether you're playing with a tablet or you're playing with a standard device, and it downloads automatically the proper assets to take advantage of that larger device. Right now it's on sale for, I believe, just under $5, $4.25, $4.75, something like that. And these guys have been pumping out pretty regular updates to it. The graphics are great. It's exactly the game you remembered. Now, one of the things I do have to tell you about, though, is that the controls are not what I would call floaty. But for those of you who remember Gianna Sisters, it's almost like a slight delay in the controls. Like when you jump, the jumping works, but like when you try to move as you jump, it's slightly off. People who have played the game before are used to that. People who are new to the game, if you look at the the comments left for the game on the Android Google Play Store, you'll see a lot of people aren't real pleased with that because it is sort of unusual, it is odd, and people don't tend to like it. It's harder using the on-screen controls. Let me just put it that way. If you're using physical controls, you get used to it a little faster. At least that's how I felt about it. Anyway, it's actually a fantastic game. Lots of different levels. Gorgeous new graphics. Again, I'm not positive if it's out for iOS or not. But if you go over to the Google Play Store, you check it out, you'll find a nice video that will take you all the way through it. And you'll see the immediate theft from Super Mario Brothers. Again, I'm not exactly sure how they got away with making this at all. But again, tons of levels, great graphics. Hey, you know, it's really hard not to recommend this. And especially if you are an old Commodore 64 head and you did not have access to Super Mario Brothers, the Great Gianna Sisters is what you played instead of Mario Brothers. And a lot of people will argue that it's actually a better game than Super Mario Brothers, even though it's obviously a direct ripoff. Still, for under $5, though, it's not bad, and I love it. Oh, there's a quote from Touch Arcade, so I'm assuming that this was released on iOS as well, since we know Touch Arcade doesn't cover Android stuff. So your mileage may vary on the Apple devices. However, fantastic soundtrack, great graphics, good gameplay, lots of levels, hard to go wrong. Great Gianna Sisters, available right now on Android and presumably iOS. Tablet-based version automatically downloads when you get it. It's hard not to recommend this game, especially for my listeners who are totally into these sort of run-and-jump games. There was, I do believe, an Amiga port as well, although it's been a while. But again, Commodore 64 is really where this guy belongs, where it came out, and those out there will probably remember it from that platform. So, Great Gianna Sisters, just under $5. Get it for your Android and iOS device. I think you'll be glad you did. Great game. Well, gang, I know it's been a rather short show. It's under an hour, which is usually unprecedented for this. However, I hope you enjoyed the show. And next month, we're going to have an interview with Robert Brolia. This is the guy that makes the fantastic .emu emulators for Android and iOS. This guy is pumping out the top-notch emulators on all sorts of platforms, with all sorts of platforms, NES, PC Engine, Mega Drive, Sega Genesis, MSX, ColecoVision. This guy has got an emulator for just about anything, and we've got an exclusive interview with him right here for Retro Gaming Radio. It's about an hour of an interview with him. He tells us what's coming next, what the next emulator he's going to release is, and he tells us about his selection process, and it's a fascinating interview. You're going to love it. That's coming up next month on Retro Gaming Radio. Be sure to follow us at Twitter, Retro Gaming Radio, without the O, because the names were too short. The requirements for Retro Gaming Radio were too long for Twitter, so now we're Retro Gaming Retro Gaming Radio minus the O on Twitter. We're also on Google+. And, of course, you can follow us anytime at RetroGamingRadio.com. And, of course, the show is available on iTunes and through your favorite podcasting directory. So be sure to check that out. And, of course, we always have the Retro Gaming Radio Plus 24-hour day, 7 days a week Shoutcast server playing up all the classic episodes of Retro Gaming Radio. Absolutely fantastic stuff. That's a big thanks to Alex J. Lopez, who's running that channel for us. And always something fun to listen to. You can hit that, by the way, with any Shoutcast player. Mobile devices, iOS and Android, both have clients that you can reach that anytime. Listen in the car, listen at work, anywhere that you can get to the internet, you can listen to the Shoutcast version of the show. And that's so great. It's so great that Alex put that up. I love just hopping right in the middle of one of these old shows and listening to these old interviews with the classic game developers. It's good stuff, so definitely check that out. And, of course, for those of you who are interested in a more social commentary show, I also offer Passenger Seat Radio, my explicit show. This is a family-friendly show, Retro Gaming Radio, work safe. Passenger Seat Radio, not so much. But you'll definitely get some interesting views. My 13-mile commute to work, I let it all hang out, so you guys can check that out as well. Again, I hope you enjoyed the show. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio saying, until next time, keep it retro.